This is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. My guest today is Sharon Brett, and we played first part of interview with her on Jaws of Justice yesterday. Today we're going to talk about some additional issues on Radioactive Magazine. Sharon is the legal director of the Kansas ACLU, and previously to that, she was a litigator for a range of civil rights and liberty issues in state and federal courts in at Harvard's Law School's Criminal Justice Policy Program. And she also has served in the past as trial attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Welcome, Sharon. Okay. I want to get into, because it's so recent and affects other issues, I'd like to start out talking about reproductive freedom. Can you tell us, first of all, everybody's heard of the case Roe v. Wade, but give us a little bit of information about the background of that.
The Roe v. Wade decision was from the 1970s and basically found that there is a right to privacy that protects bodily autonomy and choices that individuals make about their bodies and the decisions that they make in private about their bodies, which in the case in Roe concerned abortion. And the Supreme Court issued Roe and then later Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which were sort of two decisions that restricted the ability of lawmakers to regulate abortion because those regulations, in many cases, the Supreme Court found had an undue burden on the right of individuals to exercise their right to privacy, their right to bodily autonomy. So what happened at the end of June is that the U.S. Supreme Court in this term struck down those holdings from Roe and from Casey in a case called Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. And that case was challenging a recently enacted law in Mississippi that banned abortions after 15 weeks. So previously under Roe and Casey, there was sort of a viability threshold where outright bans could not be enacted that would limit abortion access pre-viability. And then you had this law that was passed in Mississippi that banned abortion at 15 weeks, which was pre-viability. And that law was upheld by the Supreme Court, and they overturned the 50 plus years of precedent from Roe and Casey in upholding that Mississippi law.
What part of the Constitution did Roe and Casey rely on to make that finding?
The Roe and Casey decisions were really looking at the issue of like substantive due process and the rights that are conferred through the U.S. Constitution that have been interpreted by the court previously to protect this right of privacy within medical decisions that individuals were making. The root of the court's decision in Roe was based in the 14th Amendment's due process clause.
All right. And I believe some other decisions are based at least partly on the same reasoning, including the Lawrence case from Texas and the case in 2015 finding the LGBT people have right to marriage. Are those cases in jeopardy now to the extent that they relied on privacy too? Is there a risk that those could be reversed. And I know that Justice Thomas and Justice Alito have both indicated they feel like those are up for grabs. But what about the other justices?
I think that's the real question that's hanging in the balance right now. Those cases that overturned statutes that prohibited same-sex marriage and overturned statutes that prohibited sodomy, those decisions were likewise grounded in this fundamental right to privacy that the Supreme Court had previously said existed in the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And so what we saw in the Dobbs opinion was a real questioning of the legal rationale and logic behind that privacy right as a whole. Obviously, the Dobbs decision was specifically in the context of the right to abortion care, but the language used in Justice Alito's majority opinion could be interpreted much more broadly than that. And in fact, Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion where he said the quiet part out loud and explicitly said that those decisions needed to be re-examined in the context of the decision in Dobbs. So I think that there's a lot of constitutional scholars and individuals who do constitutional law commentary who are sounding some alarm bells right now that this court seems willing to re-examine pretty foundational precedent to civil rights for individuals in a variety of contexts. And we should be concerned about the language and the rhetoric that was implicit in the majority opinion and explicit in Justice Thomas's concurring opinion about the direction this court is willing to go.
The other issue relating to that was interracial marriage, where the Supreme Court said that states could not ban interracial marriage. Was that based on any of the same reasoning that these cases are?
In part, but there's also a hook against bans on interracial marriage that is found in the Equal Protection Clause. So the Roe case, Casey, those were not Equal Protection Clause cases. But the Supreme Court decision that struck down the ban on interracial marriage had at least some grounding in Equal Protection Clause principles. So, you know, there was obviously a lot of commentary about why that case was not specifically mentioned in Justice Thomas's concurring opinion. Everyone knows that Justice Thomas himself is in an interracial marriage. And so there was a lot of commentary made about the fact that that decision was not mentioned, the Loving v. Virginia case. But it has some, at least some, different grounding in the Constitution than Roe.
Sharon, want to talk some about the LGBT issues. The legislature has made attempts in the last few years to restrict transgender rights. What is the ACLU position on that?
The most prominent example of the legislature's attempt to restrict the rights of transgender individuals in Kansas came in the context of the anti-trans sports bill. So last year, in the 2021 legislative session, they passed a bill that would have prohibited transgender youth from participating in sports that correspond to their gender identity. And that would be, you know, from kindergarten all the way up through college in the state of Kansas. So they passed that in 2021. The governor vetoed it, and they were unable to override the veto. So the bill died last year. But then in 2022, they passed very similar legislation again this session, and Governor Kelly vetoed it. And then once again, the legislature was unable to override Governor Kelly's veto. So we were able to assist other partners in the state in fighting back against that legislation. The ACLU stands very firmly behind the rights of transgender people in Kansas.
Okay. And is there any future litigation relating to that that's being considered or has started?
Well, we didn't have to litigate on the anti-trans sports bill because it didn't end up becoming law. But we are always keeping an eye out for issues of discrimination against LGBT individuals in Kansas. And, you know, we'll bring our resources to bear on those fights as much as we can.
All right. Let's move to First Amendment issues, where people are filming what's happening at crime scenes. And the state of Arizona just passed some new legislation. You have to be 8 feet away from the police when you do film.
The courts will look at whether an individual's right to obtain information and disseminate public information is unreasonably infringed upon. And so I think that advocates who are challenging that Arizona law or who have spoken out against the Arizona law are arguing that there's a number of problems with the law. The first, that it will violate individuals' First Amendment rights to record and disseminate public information. The second, that it will have a significant chilling effect on people's ability to exercise their right to record and disseminate public information, which is a separate First Amendment violation. And the third is that there's some broadness and vagueness issues with the law that will impact how it's enforced. So if a law says that you can't record police individual encounters within 8 feet of the encounter as it's happening, there's a lot of questions that get raised by that. What happens if the law enforcement officer moves towards you and comes more than 8 feet closer, you know, within 8 feet of you, but you have not moved? Do you have an obligation at that time to back up? At what point is a violation of the law occurring? Is it when the officer enters that 8 foot bubble? You know, there's a lot of nuance here that I think will open it up for abuse in enforcement, particularly when people are not carrying around tape measures with them to be able to tell, I am exactly 8 feet away, I'm safe. And when a lot of times the recording of these encounters is happening for a reason, because the encounter is tense, somebody wants to create a record of it. So circumstances are changing very rapidly throughout the encounter. And so it seems like a law like the one in Arizona is going to open a lot of people up for prosecution, and it will be used as an abusive tactic to get people to stop recording the police, which is a clear violation of their First Amendment rights if it's used in that sort of chilling, retaliatory way.
But isn't there also a safety issue where there's a compelling interest? If somebody is, let's say, doing this and they're 3 feet away and the police are in the middle of trying to restrain somebody, potentially somebody that might be armed with a knife or whatever. So
there's a difference between an individual situation where a law enforcement official might ask somebody to back up for a safety reason and a blanket ban on recording individuals at a certain distance, and that would subject that individual to criminal prosecution if they came within 7.5 feet. So I think there's a significant difference there. I'd also note that just a few days ago, you know, sort of relevant to Kansas in particular, just a few days ago, the 10th Circuit, which governs Kansas, issued an opinion saying there is a constitutional right to record the police. You have a First Amendment right to record the police. So virtually, I think almost every circuit that's considered the question so far has said the same thing. The Supreme Court has not issued a ruling one way or the other on the issue, but The governing law in Kansas is the law out of the 10th Circuit. So it came from a case in Denver, I think, but it is the 10th Circuit controls Kansas. And so it's the law of the land here.
All right. And I'm guessing that we probably would not want a case like that to go to Supreme Court right now with the right-wing 6-person majority that they have.
Yeah, you know, I think the Supreme Court only takes cases, or generally only takes cases where there's a significant split in the law. And there's not a significant split in the law here. Circuit courts tend to agree that this is constitutionally protected speech. You have the right to record law enforcement interactions.
Okay, let's move to voting rights and voting suppression issues.
Sure.
I saw you in an interview the other day talking about what happened in Atchison with the registration deadlines. Tell us a little bit about that.
In Atchison, Kansas, the city of Atchison, the city commission had scheduled a special election for July 14th to vote on a tax referendum that would be used to repave the roads in the city. And state law requires that 20 days before any election, voter registration must close. So the county clerk for Atchison County, which covers the city of Atchison, closed voter registration for anyone within the city limits 20 days out from that July 14th election, which meant that voter registration for people who live in the city of Atchison closed on July 23rd. However, there's a federal law, the National Voter Registration Act, which requires that registration for any election in which a federal race is on the ballot be kept open for either 30 days or for the state statutory deadline for voter registration, whichever is less. So in the case of Kansas, our state statutory deadline is 20 days prior to an election. So that's the rule that governs us under the NVRA. Because of this special election and the timing of it, voter registration for people who live in the city of Atchison was not going to reopen until after the deadline to close voter registration for the August 2nd election, which meant that if you wanted to vote on August 2nd, you needed to have registered by June 23rd. And that was a violation of the NVRA. So we were able to intervene and raise the issue with the Secretary of State's office, who then worked with the clerk to reopen registration for those who live in Atchison who wanted to vote on August 2nd, but had missed that June 23rd cutoff date. And so we were able to get people registered at the end of last week and beginning of this week. So it was a really good example of us working collaboratively with the Secretary of State's office. The ACLU of Kansas runs a nonpartisan election protection program. We run the legal component of it, and then our friends at Loudlight are running the field component and the volunteer coordination component of it. But when these issues come up, you know, when a legal issue comes up, we work to try to resolve it without having to resort to litigation. And I'm glad that we were able to do that here.
Okay. We talked about abortion before in general with Roe v. Wade. I want to talk a little bit now about the abortion issue specifically in Kansas. There's a constitutional amendment on the August 2nd primary ballot the proposed amendment would overturn what the state Supreme Court previously decided. The state Supreme Court found that there was a right to abortion in the state of Kansas based upon the state constitution.
The state Supreme Court in Kansas, and in the case Hodes and Nauzer v. Schmidt, interpreted the Kansas Bill of Rights Section 1 in particular, which has different language than the 14th Amendment in the federal constitution, and said that Section 1 of the Kansas Bill of Rights had a right to personal autonomy that guaranteed the right to an abortion. So they were interpreting different constitutional language than the Supreme Court was interpreting when it decided Roe, and based on Section 1 of our Bill of Rights.
All right. And so this proposed amendment would reverse that. Now, my understanding is it would not per se make abortion illegal, but would allow the legislature to pass legislation which could make it illegal. Is that correct?
That's right. So the constitutional amendment, if it passes, would essentially pave the way for the legislature to enact whatever restrictions on abortion that it wanted to, including an outright ban without any exceptions. The legislature, there would be no backstop in the constitution of our state that would prevent the legislature from doing that in the next legislative session.
And so when people vote without them, we can't advocate one position or the other, but when they vote, if they want to potentially or in the end ban abortion, they would want to vote in favor of the amendment. And if they do not want that, they would want to vote against it. Is that correct?
I think that's true, but I think it's even more nuanced than that. So just sort of explaining what the amendment does from a legal perspective. If the amendment fails, all of the regulations that are currently on the books in Kansas that govern abortion and that govern healthcare generally, they stay in place. They still exist. If the amendment passes, what it means is that new legislation can come down the pipe and likely will come down the pipe in Kansas. We've seen that indication from lawmakers that would even more significantly restrict, if not completely ban, all abortions in the state of Kansas.
We just have a few minutes left. Explain the difference between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause.
So the Free Exercise Clause is your right to practice your own religion. And the Establishment Clause is your right to be free from government entanglement with religion. So the Establishment Clause is the separation of church and state, right? That's the sort of common phrase that we hear when we talk about the Establishment Clause, that government should not be endorsing a particular religion or religious viewpoint, should not be passing legislation to further a government viewpoint, should not be forcing individuals to participate in a particular religion or religious practice, right? That's the Establishment Clause. And I think actually the most interesting case that came out of the end of this Supreme Court term was a free exercise clause with significant Establishment Clause impact, right? Which was the case called Kennedy about the Washington State public high school football coach who had adverse employment action taken against him because he was leading his team in Christian prayer on the 50-yard line after football games. And so he made the claim that that action taken against him violated his free exercise rights, that he's allowed to engage in prayer with his teammates at the end of a game and practice his religion in that way. And it was challenged because there were a number of individuals he challenged his sort of adverse employment action that was taken against him, but the school district was saying, look, if you're engaging in Christian prayer as a coach of a public team, you know, on public school property at the end of a football game, that is pressuring your athletes to engage in that prayer with you because they might fear that if they don't participate in this post-game ritual with you, that they'll be ostracized or that adverse action will be taken against them as student athletes. And it might just make them deeply uncomfortable, might make spectators deeply uncomfortable. And the Supreme Court said, we agree with the coach. The coach should get to lead everybody in Christian prayer at the end of a game. They wanted to respect his free exercise rights. And so I think what we saw in this Kennedy case is a willingness of the Supreme Court to uphold the free exercise rights of a predominant majority religion, you know, over some pretty significant Establishment Clause concerns. And so a lot of commentators have said, you know, it begs the question, if this was a football coach engaging in Muslim prayer or in Jewish prayer on the 50-yard line, would the U.S. Supreme Court have looked so favorably on the coach's right to engage in that prayer? And I think it raises a really valid question and signals something sort of troubling about the direction that the Supreme Court is willing to head in towards eviscerating the Establishment Clause and what it's supposed to protect.
And what about the case they decided relating to, I think it was related to taxes in one of the cities, tax support for one of the schools out in, I think it was in Maryland.
In Maine, yeah. So Maine. The ability of religious private schools to get tax breaks, you know, through a voucher system in the state of Maine. They sided with the religious school there. So I think, again, these cases read in tandem with one another, and sort of if you look at the overall move and shift towards the religious right that the court has taken on in recent years, it's fairly concerning for anybody who doesn't practice one, you know, the sort of hard right Christian majority religion. And it also is concerning for anybody who believes in an appropriate separation of church and state.
Do you think that the tilt on the court on the religious issues has any impact on how they are looking at reproductive freedom and LGBT issues when they decide those cases?
I absolutely think it does. I think that everyone wants to believe in the Supreme Court as an impartial entity that, you know, as Chief Justice Roberts always says, just calling balls and strikes. But I think you look at all of these cases in conjunction with one another and you see a religious ideology that is sort of infiltrating the court's policy decisions here. I wrote a piece about this that was in the Kansas Reflector this week that talked about the connection in that way. I think it signals a shift or a descent into a theocracy rather than a democracy. And I think it's something we should all be keeping our eyes on.
All right. I think we're out of time now. For those who just joined us, I've been talking to Sharon Brett, legal director at the Kansas chapter of the ACLU, and you've been listening to Radioactive Magazine.